So we're very interested in reprogramming. I
think I want to pause for a second on the health span issue because
rapamycin increases lifespan.
You don't get atherosclerosis as a young person. But
hi, everyone. Welcome to the final 2021 episode of the Live Longer World podcast. If you are new here, my name is Astha, and I am the host of this podcast. So today's episode is going to be a rather special one. In the past few months, I've released 6 podcast episodes and a sneak peek of the 7th one, where I've had conversations with some brilliant scientists, some biotech entrepreneurs, and also some investors that are transforming the field of longevity science. My guests are working on targeting the biology of aging itself such that we can improve our lifespans as well as our health span and enjoy more time with our loved ones. So today's episode is a rather special one because I've compiled some of the best and most informative parts, or at least what I thought, of each episode into one mashup episode. So think of it as maybe a mini tour across some concepts and research being done in the field of longevity science, where you hear from 7 incredible guests on work across epigenetic reprogramming, curing atherosclerosis, interventions like rapamycin, inflammaging, how to cure brain aging, investing in some companies that are curing Alzheimer's disease, and so on. And of course, if there's any clip or guest that piques your interest or intrigues you, you can go back and watch the entire episode with the guest. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to recap some of the previous episodes for those who missed it, and also just such that you know what to expect in this compilation to come. So sorry it might end up being a bit of a long intro, but I think it will be useful. So my first episode was with Reason, who is the founder and CEO of Repair Biotechnologies, a company that is working to cure atherosclerosis. He is also the writer and founder behind the popular blog fightaging.org. In my conversation with him, we discussed aging interventions like senolytics, NAD plus boosters, and also how his company is working to cure atherosclerosis. My second episode was with Dr. John Eber, who has a radical strategy to fight aging through tissue replacement of each of the parts of the body, including the brain, and we discussed a fair bit on brain aging and plasticity in the brain. My third episode was with Carolina Oliveira, who is the founder and CEO of OneSkin Technologies. Their first product is a topical cream that works to improve longevity in your skin by clearing away senescent cells in your skin. So we discussed a fair bit on senolytics and senescent cells as well. My fourth episode was with Dave Gobel, who is the founder and CEO of Methuselah Foundation. Methuselah invests in longevity companies such as Leucadia Therapeutics and TurnBio, and we discussed a fair bit on investing in longevity, some of the companies Methuselah has funded, and also the concept of longevity escape velocity. My fifth episode was with Dr. Matt Kaebelein, where we discussed a ton of aging interventions, including sirtuins, a lot on mTOR and rapamycin, the dog aging project, NAD plus boosters, the concept of inflammaging, and even what good science looks like. It was quite a comprehensive episode, and I recommend watching it. My sixth episode was with Dr. Morgan Levine discussing all about epigenetic clocks. We spoke about her new clock, the systems age clock. We also discussed a bit on epigenetic reprogramming, the limitations of some of these clocks, and what the future of these epigenetic clocks looks like. So if you are interested in knowing your biological age and how these clocks work, this is the episode to watch. And my seventh one, which I haven't released in its entirety, I've released a few sneak peek clips of it, was with Dr. Nir Barzilai discussing his work on centenarians and metformin. So I have included some more clips in this mashup episode, but stay tuned till the new year to watch the entire episode. All right, with that very long intro, we are almost ready to dive into today's mashup episode of the Live Longer World podcast. Before I let you jump into that, I want to let you know that if you want to stay notified of upcoming podcast releases, you can sign up on my website at livelongerworld.com/podcast. And there you will also find links to the podcast to listen to it or watch it on whichever medium you prefer, be it Apple, Spotify, Google, YouTube, or other platforms. I also have social media, so you can follow my work on Twitter at livelongerworld and Instagram at longevityfuture. If you wish to support my work, I have Patreon, which is patreon.com/livelongerworld. And lastly, you can also support my work by leaving up to a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribing to my YouTube, liking the videos, and sharing it with your friends and family. Okay, with that, I wish everyone an amazing holiday season, and I hope each of you get to spend some quality time with your friends and family, or however you want to spend the holiday season. Enjoy today's episode, and I will catch you in the new year.
When it comes to thinking about aging, you don't only think about it in terms of molecular mechanisms, but you've also started thinking about it from a functional decline perspective. Right. I'd love it if you could discuss a bit about how you think about aging and the functional decline piece of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think both are important. And I think just to take a step back, I think one of the things that often gets lost when we talk about aging is that different people define aging differently. And so, you'll notice sometimes that there are these arguments or, heated discussions about aging. And a lot of times what it boils down to are different definitions. And so I think it's really important that, when we're having these discussions that we're clear about what we're talking about, right? So I've been studying the biology of aging, for a long time now, as you suggested. And so that's kind of I immediately gravitate towards the biology, right? What is it that changes about the biology and the physiology of animals and people as we get older, right? Which is related to chronological aging, but not equivalent, right? This idea that different people age at different rates and our biological aging process, may be accelerated or delayed in different individuals. So I think that's kind of the way I always think about aging. And even within the biology of aging, as you suggested, you can think about it from the molecular perspective, the sort of hallmarks of aging perspective. What are the types of changes, damage that happens as we get older at the cellular molecular level? Then those are important to understand mechanisms of aging and to give us potential targets to go after with therapies and interventions. We need that molecular understanding so we can predict what we should be doing from an interventional perspective. But then once we have interventions, in order to evaluate the efficacy of those interventions, we really need to start thinking about, in my view, functional measures of aging. So lifespan is great. Like lifespan is what we use in the laboratory to test whether a drug or a treatment is affecting aging. That's not pragmatic or practical in people, right? So we really need these functional measures of aging that we can evaluate whether the intervention is actually working. And so what I think of when I think about functional measures of aging, some of them are the obvious stuff. How well is our immune system functioning? How well is our heart functioning? How well is our brain functioning, right? Some of those are easier to measure than others. But I think also there are functional measures, just like pain, chronic inflammation, tendinitis, right? That's a really good example. A lot of people suffer from tendinitis and it affects their daily life. That is not completely due to aging, but it's definitely age associated. You are at a greater risk of chronic inflammation and tendinitis as you get older. We can evaluate whether interventions affect those sorts of functional quality of life measures, but people don't think about that a lot. It seems like in this field, at least. I think geriatricians are more used to thinking about these functional measures, grip strength, walking speed, mm-hmm. things like that. We don't really think about that so much on the basic biology of aging side. And I think we should, because I think that's what we really have a chance to evaluate whether these interventions are working or not. The last thing I'll say on that is that, you know, I don't think that these functional measures are exclusively what we should be looking at. There's a lot of interest in looking at clocks, you know, biomarkers of aging. That absolutely is going to be important. The only point I would make is I don't think it's helpful if your intervention changes the biological clock and it doesn't improve functional measures of aging, right? Because that's really what we want to do. Those two things should go together. And if they don't, then I'd say your clock doesn't work very well.
Can you tell us a bit about what is the system's age clock and how it even came to be? What's the history behind it?
Yeah, so the system's age clock really came about because we had this one question of, if I have two people with the exact same chronological age and the exact same predicted epigenetic age, are they really the same biologically? And we actually were thinking, you know, there actually could be multiple ways people get to a specific epigenetic age, right? You might be accelerating in a certain domain, whereas another person could be accelerated in a different domain, but you, because it's all averaged together, end up in the same place. And this is really because we know not only do people differ in how fast they're aging, but they also differ in kind of how they're aging. So this is really well characterized in Mike Snyder's paper, where they didn't use epigenetics or methylation in that paper, but they used proteomics and RNA-seq and all these other omics based to categorize people into what they call ageotypes, and showed, you know, some people have accelerated kidney and liver aging, but slower immune aging. So we kind of went back and thought, well, maybe we can do this using methylation. So what we did for the systems clock is to first take normal clinical measures that people use to assess different organ functions. So you have things like ALT or something for a liver, or, you know, you have different immune markers for kind of immune health, and group them according to a system. So we ended up with, I believe it's 9 systems. So liver, kidney, heart, immune. We separated immune and cytokine, like inflammation, blood, brain, hormone, and I might be forgetting one, but, and we basically made clinical measures to estimate kind of aging or processes in each of those, and then trained epigenetic clocks of each one. So then you end up with 8 separate epigenetic clocks, or 9 separate epigenetic clocks that are specific to different systems. We can combine them into a whole clock to get kind of your holistic aging, which so far it seems like this clock is more predictive of morbidity and mortality than any of the existing epigenetic clocks. But what we think is more exciting is we can actually use this to understand different profiles of people. So group people according to aging faster versus slower in certain systems or domains. And what are the things that contribute to faster aging in one of these domains versus another? What does it mean in terms of risk of specific diseases? So if I'm aging faster in heart but slower in, let's say, brain system, does that mean I'm going to be much more at risk of cardiovascular disease but less of Alzheimer's? And I think from the original clocks, you weren't able to get that kind of fine grain information.
Organ SNSL seems to be quite promising already, just the area of analytics. What is the latest development in that field?
Senolytics is the general name for drugs that kill senescent cells. It's a subdivision of the broader development of therapies that we'll call senotherapeutics, which also covers efforts to prevent cells from becoming senescent and efforts to make senescent cells less horrible if they are going to be senescent. I think that the prevention has some promise in the sense that mTOR inhibitors do seem to prevent cells become senescent to a big enough degree to perhaps be interesting and competitive if it works out. There isn't the weight of evidence yet to say that this is actually real. But if you could find other things that that can, let's say, halve the number of senescent cells in your body if you take it over 6 months, just by affecting the turnover. Senescent cell accumulation isn't actually, by the look of it, by the way, a matter of getting these senescent cells and they just sit there forever. Mm-hmm. It appears to be a turnover problem. You generate more of them because your body is more damaged and cells are more unhappy than you do in youth. And you get rid of them less effectively because your immune system is becoming dysfunctional. So if you could affect the turnover on either side, maybe you're good, but there isn't much, the work on destroying them is much more advanced than the work on preventing cells from becoming senescent. And there's this fear that if you're preventing cells from becoming senescent, you're actually sometimes going to increase the risk of cancer because some of those cells should have become senescent because they were damaged. Senescence is an anti-cancer mechanism at root, one that goes out of control and becomes wild when you get too old. So senolytics as an industry, which is what I was originally going to say before I sidebarred myself there, senolytics as an industry is very, very unusual and very interesting, because the first drug combination that was developed in animals is actually really, really good. And nobody's yet done much better than that, where they've published data. So you have an industry where a drug, dasatinib, combined with a supplement, quercetin, is actually as good as whatever they're rolling out of the drug development pipeline. So it should be interesting to see how that pans out, because the first thing that's going to happen as soon as the Mayo Clinic finishes up their dasatinib trials in a way that's compelling, you're going to see enormous off-label use everywhere. And in fact, you're already seeing significant off-label use of dasatinib and quercetin, and a community of people growing who are using these drugs and claiming good effects from them in terms of, you know, addressing their age-related concerns. So that's going to be a bit of a problem for all these people who want to charge you, you know, $10,000 a year for whatever senolytic drug they're putting out. There's a tremendous diversity of those drugs being developed. There's gene therapies, there's immunotherapies.
Inflammaging. I know you mentioned how you've recently become very bullish on it. Can you just briefly explain what it is, why I guess you got more bullish on it, and any sort of therapies that are being developed or tested to target this inflammation process?
Sure. So I'm not an immunologist. I'll start with that disclaimer. So I'm gonna talk about inflammaging from a very sort of high level, conceptual, simplistic perspective. So first thing I think it's important to appreciate is, and I'm guilty of this sometimes too, you know, we often talk about immune function declining with age, right? Mm-hmm. That's misleading, because I mean, while it's true that your immune system declines in its function from the context of being able to protect you against pathogens and things like that, look at COVID-19, right? That's like as age associated as Alzheimer's disease is, at least in terms of risk of death. So your immune system does decline in that context. At the same time, your immune system becomes hyperactivated in inappropriate ways. So it's not just a global decrease in function, it's a decrease in its normal function with a gain of function in abnormal ways, like autoimmunity, right? So inflammaging, you know, can really be thought of, I think, as that change in the immune system that goes along with aging, both a decline in the ability to respond to infections, cancer surveillance, the normal function the immune system does to maintain health, but at the same time, getting hyperactivation of the immune system in ways that are damaging, right? And so autoimmunity is one example of that. But also, you get one of the things that seems to be happening is you get infiltration of immune cells into tissues, like microglia infiltrating tissues, and then they actually are damaging to those tissues. Senescent cells are another example of inflammaging. So senescent cells accumulate with age. These are cells that leave the cell cycle, so they stop doing what they're supposed to do. But it's worse than that, because they don't only leave the cell cycle, but they start giving off all of these inflammatory cytokines. That might actually be part of what recruits the macrophages to come in there and do bad stuff, right? So that's the way I think about inflammaging. And what we're seeing in mice, and I think we see this in people as well, is that many of the declines in function that go on in different tissues are at least strongly associated with a chronic inflammatory environment. And many of the interventions that are most effective turn that down or turn it off. And rapamycin absolutely fits into that. We see this in tissue and tissue after tissue. There's a strong inflammatory increase with age, and rapamycin potently shuts it down. Same thing is true with caloric restriction. One of the most robust effects of caloric restriction is turning off this chronic inflammatory signal that goes along with aging. So it's a commonality that the interventions that actually work in mice do have this effect of turning down this chronic inflammatory state. So it's kind of those two things together, right? You can make a plausible mechanistic argument for inflammation driving functional declines with age, and the interventions that we know work seem to hit that pretty well. The other thing that has solidified, you know, my sort of growing belief that this is important is that if you look at the hallmarks of aging, and that's kind of the classic sort of molecular way that people think about aging biology. If you look at the hallmarks of aging, a bunch of those can cause inflammation, right? So mitochondrial dysfunction can cause inflammation. DNA damage can cause inflammation. Senescent cells, I already talked about, can cause inflammation. So, you know, those can be, that can be something that is, that ties together a lot of these molecular hallmarks of aging that people in the field have identified over the last couple of decades. So I don't want to suggest that this is the only thing that's driving functional declines and disease risk with aging, but I think it's pretty important. And if I had to pick one thing, I'd say it's probably the most important, or at least maybe the most amenable to targeting therapeutically right now, in terms of having an impact on health and function as we get older.
Is skin aging, and perhaps why it's been overlooked, and then we can dive into what your company OneSkin is doing to actually reverse some of that skin damage.
Yes, of course. Yeah, so basically when we started studying skin aging, we realized that, you know, the same mechanisms that are behind skin aging is also behind in our other tissues aging. So we were interested in the accumulation of, you know, damaged senescent cells that has been regarded as, you know, a central event in aging. And a lot of studies have also shown that if we can eliminate those cells, you know, from tissues and from the whole organism, we can recover, we can rejuvenate, mouse, and then we can kind of, you know, restore the functionality of that tissue and, you know, the whole organism. And what we realize is that, you know, one of the main, I would say, problems of senescent cells is that they start secreting those inflammatory signals, right? What we call CESP. So the senescent cells itself, I would say, is not so bad, but when they start secreting those factors, they basically induce other cells around to become senescent, to enter in this senescent state. So they work like a bad apple in a basket, spoiling, you know, the good apples around. And if you think that those senescent cells are accumulating in our skin, and if you think of the size of the organ, you know, that skin is, when that inflammation that's been secreted, like build up, and then it gets to your bloodstream, that can really, you know, impact the onset of other chronic diseases, and even can be related to mortality risk. So it's very interesting when we see studies, for example, of people that have psoriasis or other, you know, inflammatory skin conditions, that they have like higher chances to develop cardiovascular diseases. And that's basically, you know, inflammation that's coming from your skin. But the same happens when your skin ages, you know, the skin barriers gets weaker, and then you have, you know, that release of inflammation into your body, into your bloodstream, that can be, you know, affecting, you know, the onset of those chronic diseases.
So metformin is this drug that has been initially used to treat malaria and influenza, I believe, and then it's been used as a diabetes drug, still very popular for that reason. And then I think researchers begin to find out that, well, it could actually be used as a longevity drug too. I'm curious, how did people come to find that out?
So I have to tell you, metformin was in Europe much before it came to Israel, like decades more. I think metformin was improved for therapy only in 1993. And I was a fellow at Yale in 1987 when pharmaceuticals started bringing metformin to the United States. And I've done a study to discover the mechanism of action of metformin for diabetes. Okay. Now, although I was interested in aging then and I had an aging project, I never thought of metformin then as a gerotherapeutics. But what happened with metformin throughout the years is there were clinical studies. Okay, so those are control studies, right? Control blinded studies that showed that metformin prevents cardiovascular disease. Metformin prevents diabetes in non-diabetics. Metformin delays cognitive decline. And association studies, like hundreds of studies showing that people with metformin have less cancers, all kind of cancers, and also less Alzheimer's. So it all became, in my mind, it became clear that it's not that by accident, and by the way, it's not through glucose, okay? They are all, sometimes with metformin, your glucose is worse. It's not through glucose. That metformin had specific effects on many other diseases, okay? Which is our definition of aging, okay? Aging drives those diseases.
Around epigenetic reprogramming, I'm curious, just you, because you published a paper with a few other people in the field. What was your work around that, and how does it relate to some of the clock work as well?
Yeah, so we're very interested in reprogramming. I know some people are really interested in it from a kind of a therapeutic perspective. I'm very interested in it just from a fundamental basic biology perspective. I mean, I think the discovery by Yamanaka that you can take even an old somatic cell and basically convert it back to an embryonic state is amazing in and of itself, regardless of if it ever even has any translational application. And we're really interested in it because it seems to be that it's acting through remodeling the epigenome, which we can very clearly pick up using things like the clocks. So you can see that upon reprogramming, you see a drop in the epigenetic clock, not for all clocks, but the majority of clocks that we apply. And, you know, you can even see it. We have looked at some data where you have the time course between, you know, the somatic cell, and you have maybe every few days showing the change in epigenetic age as a function of this reprogramming. And to me, the really exciting part is prior to these cells de-differentiating or turning back into kind of a pluripotent stem cell, when they're still maintaining their identity, they're actually seem to be rejuvenating. So they lose kind of the aging kind of changes first before converting into a stem cell. So that's really exciting that you can actually wipe some of these aging changes. And it's not because you're just taking a fully differentiated cell and making it pluripotent again. So we are doing tons of experiments into reprogramming and trying to link it to the epigenetic aging that we see. So what changes change with age, and what are responsive to reprogramming, and why are they remodeled and reprogramming, and what does this mean? And are there different factors that might act on different ones, and, you know, all these different things. So yeah, I have about four people who are working on reprogramming.
Acadia Therapeutics. The founder, Doug Athel, his theory was, we've been spending the last 30 years trying to clean the brain of A-beta and tau tangles, and we've spent $25 to $30 billion and wasted every dime of it because we still have no solutions. And everybody keeps following that. It's like the Indians would stampede buffalo over the cliff. Well, why do the buffalo keep running over the cliff? We're not that much different than buffalo, it turns out. We're all stampeding in the same direction. Well, he said, nope, I'm going to start over. I don't want to waste my life going in a useless direction. So he went back to first principles, which is always a good thing to do, and asked about where does Alzheimer's start and what are its early symptoms? Well, one symptom was loss of a sense of smell. And the etiology of Alzheimer's is that it begins, if you think of it as a fire, the fire begins or is sparked just above the olfactory bulbs, which is where you smell, your sense of smell. So he said, wow, that's interesting. So he began to, he further investigated and began to focus on a thing called a cribriform plate, which is a mixture of bone, meat, vessels, nerves, with pathways, actual holes in the bone. It's a lot like a lava rock in consistency.
That sits where, in the nose?
If you get shot between the eyes,
right,
that's where the cribriform plate is.
I see.
So anyway, his hypothesis in, let's see, when was it? Can't remember, 2016 maybe. No, he put out a paper in 2013, and I heard him give a presentation on the paper in 2015 on the hypothesis. It was basically that the plumbing was clogged. The cerebrospinal fluid, when it goes through your brain, is constantly cleaning your brain from the inside out. It goes toward the back, down the spinal column into the lymphatic system. So it goes from lymphatic to lymphatic and gets cleaned up out of the brain. But the prefrontal areas of the brain, the front, goes through the cribriform plate. And the theory was simply, well, if the toilet is clogged, it doesn't matter if you try to clean the toilet. You have to unclog the toilet.
Right.
So then we took a look at cadaver cribriform plates, and without knowing what cause of death was, we graded them on a scale of most closed or occluded to least closed or occluded. After rank stacking them, we then opened the database of cause of death. It was, I think, Veterans Administration. And it turns out that the correlation coefficient was almost perfect. The more clogged, the more they died from Alzheimer's. The less clogged, the more they died of something else. Well, that was a really wonderful signal, but correlation is not necessarily causation.
Right.
So then we, the Methuselah Foundation, funded a trial to use ferrets, which have a very, very high speed near-term memory system. They go into dark tunnels looking for food, other animals. They've never been in the tunnel before. They follow their nose to find the prey. And then when they've got the prey, there's nothing their nose can do for them. They have to use inertial guidance, reverse the guidance to figure out how to get out of a tunnel they've never been in before, which, by the way, is completely dark. So Doug had this brilliant idea of using ferrets as a test animal. And so he did surgery on the control, a mock surgery on the controls, and then actual surgery on the test branch of the experiment to partially close their cribriform plates. And the result of the study is that over time, gradually, the treated population, their behavior began to change. they lost their fear. They became more unpredictable. They couldn't find their way out of a paper bag, much less the mock tunnels that Doug had put together. So that's a real signal. We didn't totally occlude them. We partially occluded them, which was more relevant to the human condition, where with time, the cribriform plate becomes calcified and the openings close up. So I've spent a lot of time on this, but it's an example of the risk that a foundation like ourselves can take.
Let's talk about tissue replacement in the brain then.
Yeah. So tissue replacement obviously has to be done progressively. You know, you can't, like other organs of the body, you can replace wholesale and it's fine. You can replace your heart, you know, your lungs, your kidneys, anything, and it's still you. Your brain, you can't do that. You know, your brain is you. And so the only way to replace it is progressively over time. But because of this plasticity and that functions, if you're using them, and they're important to you, functions and memories will move from one part of the neocortex or one part of the brain to another over time. So because of that, the nature of how the brain works, this plastic nature of how the brain works, that means that we could replace tissue progressively over time without losing who we are as individuals, without losing our self-identity, without losing our memories, or you know, our ability to perform any tasks that we like to perform. So, you know, that should be possible in principle, and it should also be possible in practice, because we know how the brain normally develops from precursor cells, so we have a pretty good understanding. And at least we understand that the precursor cells know what to do and how they do it, even though we don't have, you know, the finest detail understanding of all the molecules and genetic pathways that control that. But we know that they can do it, and we know that these cells, how these early brain precursor cells form brain tissue. And that's essentially what my lab and others are working on, is how to get these very immature brain precursor cells to form entire new tissue. And so the difficulty comes from the fact that there are many brain cell types that we need to generate to form a functional tissue.
So you mentioned mTOR a couple of times. Can you explain what mTOR is? And I think also maybe the distinction between mTOR1 and mTOR2. And then we can move on to how rapamycin interacts with mTOR and what gets you so excited about rapamycin.
Sure. So I'll start from kind of a conceptual perspective, because I think in order to understand, you know, why, what mTOR is and what it does, it's useful to start from that sort of a perspective. So, you know, the way I think about it is, if you think back through evolutionary sort of timescales, there are a few fundamental decisions that every organism has to make that, you know, are really important for the evolutionary success of that organism, right? So I'm thinking about this from, you know, the perspective of natural selection and evolution, right? So let's just say you're a single-celled organism. You know, you need to query the environment and make a decision based on the environment. Is it a good time to reproduce or not, right? Because if you reproduce at the wrong time and it's a bad environment, your progeny are going to die and you're not going to be evolutionarily successful. So One way to think about mTOR is it is one of the major factors in the cell that helps cells make that decision. Sense the environment and based on the environment, decide whether to reproduce or not. And so if you think about the things in the environment that are really the key determinants of that decision, there's not very many, right? There's food, which is probably the most important. There's no food around, don't have babies. That's a good evolutionary strategy. Temperature, the temperature is wrong. You probably don't want to reproduce. You want to become stress resistant. And maybe oxygen, depending on, you know, your what sort of organism you are. So, and TOR responds to all of those, right? So basically nutrient levels is probably the most important factor that regulates TOR, but TOR also responds to oxygen and also responds to temperature. So TOR is sort of the gatekeeper of reproduction is the way I think about it. Sense the environment signals through you know, still being worked out pathways to increase or decrease TOR activity based on the environment. High TOR activity is associated with growth and reproduction. So lots of food, high TOR. Low TOR activity is associated with shutting down reproduction and becoming stress resistant. Not very much food, low TOR. Okay. So what rapamycin does is it inhibits TOR. So it kind of tricks the cell into thinking that it's a low food environment, shuts down growth and reproduction or turns it down, and enhances stress resistance. So that's a very sort of simplistic viewpoint of TOR, but I reasons why I still view rapamycin as you know, the gold standard of longevity interventions, at least pharmacological longevity interventions, is that we know that rapamycin itself can increase lifespan in every animal model or cellular model where it's been tested, yeast, worms, flies, mice. We know that the genetic correlate of that, so genetically turning down mTOR complex 1, also increases rapamycin, increases lifespan in all of those model systems. So you've got the drug, you've got the genetics lining up. And it's by far the most robust and reproducible pharmacological intervention for increasing lifespan in mice. So unlike things like nicotinamide riboside, where, you know, one person reports it extends lifespan, another group can't reproduce it. Same thing with sirtuin activators. Everybody gets rapamycin to extend lifespan, and it's usually not small effects. So, you know, I think the lowest effect is 9% that's been reported, and the highest is around 30%. And it, you know, usually in that 20% range, which is definitely the most robust and reproducible pharmacological method for extending lifespan in mice. And it's not only lifespan, but in pretty much every organ or tissue where you look, you can find evidence that rapamycin is either delaying the declines in function, or I think what's most exciting, actually reversing functional declines associated with aging. And we talked about functional measures of aging. And I think if you can reverse, if you can take an old mouse where function is not very good, treat it for eight weeks with a drug and make function better, that's exactly what we want, right? And we know that's true for rapamycin, at least in immune, brain, heart and oral cavity. You see reversal of aging functional declines in about 6 to 8 weeks of treatment. So it's pretty exciting.
Atherosclerosis, a new project, cholesterol degrading. Can you talk a bit more about that and what you're trying to do there? And it seems like you also have promising results in mice so far. So would be great to hear that.
So atherosclerosis is primarily a condition in which the macrophage cells in your body become dysfunctional. These macrophage cells are innate immune cells. They just come straight out of your bone marrow and other locations. And they usually hang out in the spleen as monocytes and then go into your bloodstream to like go out and find problems. And when they find an area of your blood vessel wall that's inflamed or damaged, they dive in there, become macrophages and start to repair it. And the major issue in the body in this context is cholesterol. Cholesterol is needed everywhere in your body. The cells use it to make up their membranes. Cholesterol is also not really destroyed locally. Cells have to go fetch cholesterol by picking it up from the environment. And when they have too much of it, they pass it back into the environment. They don't really have the option to manufacture it or get rid of it locally. It's expensive. So it's made, for the first approximation, it's made in the liver. Then it gets put into the bloodstream and carried around on LDL particles. And cells ingest these LDL particles as needed. And if they have too much cholesterol, they give it back to HDL particles that take it back to the bloodstream and send it back to the liver. And this huge Rube Goldberg system evolved probably because cholesterol is so abundant in the body that you can't evolve a way to just break it down without killing cells, because cells need cholesterol for their membranes. So what happens is you get like too much cholesterol or oxidized cholesterol in the blood vessel walls, and that annoys the blood vessel wall cells, and they call for help. You get macrophages coming in and they try to clean it up. And this works great when you're young. Later in life, you get these areas where it runs out of control. The macrophage, you don't get atherosclerosis as a young person. Macrophages come in, they try to clean it up, they get overwhelmed and die. And they contribute to this growing mass of fat in your blood vessel wall that just keeps adding more and more fat, and it's constantly calling for more macrophages to come in and try to clean it up, and they come in and they try to clean it up and they fail and they die. And this just continues as a feedback loop. So everybody so far in the research and development community has settled on, well, let's try to lower the amount of cholesterol in the bloodstream as a way to do this. And every single drug so far deployed does this in one way or another. But if you have an established area of plaque, this sort of fatty macrophage graveyard full of gunk that's just going to kill more macrophages, lowering bloodstream cholesterol really doesn't help that much. It just slows things down a little bit. You get about a 20% reduction in mortality at best. And in this environment where everybody and their dog is taking statins to lower their blood cholesterol, it still kills 25% of everybody. So we need to do better than that. And the doing better than that is, let's go get rid of the cholesterol that's in the plaque itself. That is the problem. And the way you do that really is by making the macrophages resistant to that environment in some way, shape, or form. And our approach is to genetically engineer the macrophages to give them the ability to break down cholesterol locally into a safe byproduct. So that enables the macrophages to, in principle, just continue to operate as they would in youth. And it doesn't matter how much plaque you have, given enough macrophages, they will break it down and get rid of it and gradually return the blood vessels to normal. So, you know, any approach that made macrophages completely invulnerable to their environment would work. And obviously getting that approach is kind of troubling. There's some things you can do that seem to work decently well in mice, but we think our approach is sufficiently comprehensive and direct that we don't have to worry about any of the fiddly problems about differences between mice and humans or problems with metabolism that occur in some of those other approaches. And as you mentioned, our approach works really well in mice. We delivered an AAV gene therapy to mice and with a pretty high dose, and it was perfectly safe, very well tolerated, and halved the amount of lipids in unstable plaque in these mice. And if you can get rid of the cholesterol that's making soft, unstable plaque soft and unstable, then, you know, if you get rid of half of that, then you've roughly halved the mortality risk due to those plaques rupturing and then causing a stroke or a heart attack. And that's what we do in a nutshell, and we're hard at work with our huge vivarium full of hundreds of overweight atherosclerotic mice awaiting injections of various approaches to therapy.
What else are you excited about in the field of clocks? Questions that you're super excited that your lab is exploring, other labs are exploring?
So probably two things. So one is single cell approaches. So I know there's a few labs. So Vadim Gladyshev's lab has worked a little bit on single cell approaches. We're really interested in doing single cell, not because I think they're going to be good biomarkers. I actually think single cell is not the right approach for a biomarker because it's exorbitantly expensive. And so, you know, if I can get almost as good a prediction from bulk as I can for single cell, it doesn't make sense to multiply your cost by, you know, 1,000-fold or something like that. We are interested in it just from understanding how individuals' cells age. Because right now, for the clocks, it's not clear whether the changes are happening in an individual cell. So whether this cell is gaining methylation or losing methylation at a given site with age, or whether cells that have methylation at that site are just taking over with age. So those are kind of, if that makes sense, two different things. And the clocks would, the bulk clocks would treat them the same. They would not be able to distinguish those two things. And it's only at the single cell can I say the cells themselves are aging versus aging just selects for different types of cells. And I think that'll be really important when we start thinking about interventions or even reprogramming. Is reprogramming, do the majority of cells who end up expressing the Yamanaka factors actually move backwards in time, essentially? Or does it just give a selective advantage to ones that have a given profile? And all of a sudden they are able to move back and take over the whole kind of cell miniature population or whatever. So that's kind of one thing that we're really interested in. And then the other is kind of parabiosis, which I think of as similar to reprogramming. We're not interested in parabiosis as in and of itself, like actually connecting circulatory systems, but how do circulating factors, we actually think the ones that are accumulating with age drive aging in cells. So how is it the cells are responding, or why are they responding to circulating aging factors? And what is it about those factors that's causing aging in the cells? And if you remove those, how do the cells kind of respond and kind of are able to kind of rejuvenate in some manner?
What is good science? Because
Sure. So yeah, I mean, I think this idea is really important and unfortunately underappreciated. So, you know, my view, especially in the world of basic science, my view is that, you know, we try to explain biological process based on the data that we've got at hand, right? And we're really good at drawing models. You know, and I talked before about how we like to make these linear models, you know, A interacts with B causes C, right? I think that's really valuable to do that. But I think what we should do when we do experiments is think about our model and identify ways that we can try to break it, right? So the one thing that I think, if I could just get every scientist, every biologist to appreciate this, I think it would be great. Look, your model is wrong. It's wrong. It is an imperfect representation of reality based on the data that we have today. And we know we don't know everything, right? So our goal should be to figure out how is it wrong? Because if we do that, then we make it better. And that's how we should try to design experiments. I'm not perfect at that, but I try to take that approach and to train, you know, the students and postdocs in my lab to try to take that approach. Unfortunately, you know, what I have seen over and over and over again is the opposite approach, where people try to design experiments to prove their model. And there are lots of reasons why that's a mistake. I think the biggest one, though, is that when you do that and you get a result that doesn't fit your expectations, you are then inclined to ignore that result and think it was wrong, right? I don't think that's not making up data, but the effect is the same, right? Because you are being misled and you are misleading the scientific community by leaving that data out.
But we should have more than one time study and maybe around the world, because we need to be convincing. We need to come up that nobody doubts us that aging can be modified.
Hello again, everyone. I hope you enjoyed today's mashup episode as a 2021 finale of the Live Longer World podcast. If you did, please show some support and subscribe to the YouTube, like the video, leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, or share it with your friends and family. If you also want to be notified of upcoming podcast releases, you can sign up on my website, which is livelongerworld.com/podcasts. Other ways to follow my work are through social media. I am on Twitter @LiveLongerWorld and Instagram @LongevityFuture. And of course, you can always support my work through Patreon as well, which is patreon.com/LiveLongerWorld. Lastly, my best wishes to everyone for the holiday season and wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I look forward to seeing all of you in 2022.